This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. The first references to cheese go way, way back in time. There's archaeological evidence of cheesemaking in Mesopotamian and Sumerian civilizations 7,000 years ago. And there may have been cheesemaking as long as 11,000 years ago. Cheese has been lovingly made for centuries by small producers whose commitment to quality over quantity is laudable. But then you have the 1980s, when I was a little kid, and my elementary school colleagues were bringing in Cheese Whiz into the school cafeteria to squirt onto Ritz crackers. Suffice it to say, cheese has a wild and varied history. And yes, before you say it, I know I probably can't even put Cheese Whiz into a conversation about real cheese. But I would tell you I can. Cheese Whiz is an entry in no less than the Oxford Companion to Cheese. So before I get myself deeper into trouble, why don't I just introduce my guests and let them tell you about cheese. Catherine Donnelly is a professor of nutrition and food sciences at UVM. Mateo Keeler is co-owner of Jasper Hill Farm in Greensboro. Catherine is the editor-in-chief of the Oxford Companion to Cheese, and Mateo wrote the foreword. What a pleasure to have both of you on the show today. Welcome to Vermont Edition.
It's great to be here.
Thank you, Jane.
Mateo, you write in the foreword to this very large book, cheese is primordial. And I think you're kind of referring both to its actual chemical makeup, but also to its place in history and human civilization. That is quite a claim to say cheese is primordial. Back it up.
Well, we are mammals after all. And, you know, when I think about the work that we do every day, we're milking cows and you know, aggregating protein, storing it up for some later date where at this point we can really choose to enjoy, and we've like elevated the art of and the craft of cheesemaking. But for thousands of years, you know, there's been this effort to, you know, collect the fat of the land and store it away for winter. And ultimately that's a survival strategy that has grown up and may be responsible for accelerating human civilization as we know it.
How do you say that? How could cheese be responsible for accelerating human civilization?
Well, it corresponds to the beginnings of animal agriculture and you know, that settled agrarian life that accompanied it, in that, you know, for thousands of years, humans were lactose intolerant, and many people still are. It means that if you had a lactating mammal, a sheep, a goat, a camel, a cow, humans weren't drinking milk. They had to
other than their mother's milk, which then
other than their mother's milk. But at a certain point, humans stopped producing lactase, the enzyme that allowed them to break down lactose and digest that. And so it was really a human mutation that has enabled us to, you know, drink milk. But cheesemaking was therefore a fundamental part of taking advantage of that rich protein source up until, you know, not so distant past. So that's what I mean. It's human civilization and cheesemaking have
really
grown up together.
Catherine, there's a myth of how the first cheese may have been produced, which you know, takes place in Mesopotamia, and said an Arab trader may have been taking milk with him and put it in an animal's stomach pouch to carry, and then the natural rennet in that animal's stomach coagulated that milk and turned it into sort of a fresh cheese. Do you think that there's any truth to that story of how the first cheese may have come about?
It's debatable. I think most historians agree that is now recognized as a lovely myth. What we do know from recent archaeology and some amazing findings is shrouds of pottery that were discovered as far as 11,000 years ago that contain milk proteins and are thought to be the first milk collection vessels or strainers for cheesemaking. And this work is being done out of the United Kingdom, looking at a very detailed chemical analysis of pottery shards, and it's fascinating work.
So what's the better theory, then, of how cheese may have actually first come to be, or how people realized that they could make cheese out of milk?
So in the regions where cheesemaking originated, regions of Turkey, Anatolia, areas like that, I think that it is likely that a fresh cheese was made, probably coagulated with or acidified, maybe with citrus, which was predominant in the region. It's all, you know, debatable, but it probably was likely more of a fresh cheese instead of a rennetted variety. But further research will let us know.
We're talking today about cheese. Listeners, what do you want to know about the history of it, its role in shaping our culture, if that's not too grand a thing to say? Our guests believe that cheese does deserve an exalted status, and they know a lot, not only about the history of cheese, but how it's made, what its chemical composition can tell us about our own microbiome. They can answer your cheese questions. Call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211 with your gastronomic inquiries, or post a note on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Matteo Keeler, can you define rennet for us? Because it's an important ingredient in many cheeses.
So rennet is originally an extraction of it's an enzyme that is naturally occurring in the abomasum, which is the fourth stomach of an unweaned ruminant, right? So when we're making cheese, what we're doing is really mimicking the way that a calf or a kid or a lamb would digest milk. There are a number of different varieties of coagulants. Animal rennet would be, you know, the most traditional, but Sephardic Jews in Portugal and Spain have used thistles, cardoon thistles, which have an enzyme that plays a similar role, figs. And then there are scientifically produced forms of chymosin, which is an enzyme that cleaves milk proteins and causes them to attract one to another. So those are generally produced through a genetic engineering of specific microbes that have a gene inserted to produce these enzymes.
And Catherine, I understand this is sort of where you come into this discussion, or the angle that you approached it from, and now you probably know way more than you ever thought you would about everything regarding cheese. But you're a professor of nutrition and food sciences, so is this idea of the microbial makeup and the chemical composition of cheese something that really interests you? You apologize to the non-scientists at the beginning of the book.
Yes, I do, although I hope everyone can find that inner scientist in them. but for me, as a food microbiologist, cheese is probably the premier example of what happens when you allow for controlled fermentation or controlled rotting. My dear friend Paul Kinstead, a cheese expert, would say all the beautiful veins and blooms and surfaces and rinds, they're all attributable to microbial activity, and it's part of what makes cheesemaking fascinating.
Matteo, we're actually sitting here in front of some of your beautiful cheese. You and your brother run the cellars at Jasper Hill, and I'm salivating, so I hope you'll cut some and we can taste a little bit of it. But I'm also thinking about the fact that every bite of cheese contains, 10 billion living microbes, which might put some people off their camembert.
That's exactly true. I mean, cheese is really one of the few truly living foods that we consume. And I think it's one of the reasons why we're so attracted to it, maybe even on a primordial level.
Why? Why would we be attracted? I mean, I understand scientifically why we need microbes, but you think, I mean, Sometimes I think about when I'm looking at a really lovely blue cheese, you know, those veins, or I am sort of scraping the mold off a hard cheese that's been out for too long and then eating the inside of it. Or I'm looking at the rind and thinking about how that was made and thinking, who in the world ever thought that this was edible in the first place? Or you open a cheese and smell it and, oh, my God. I mean, sometimes the smell could put you off and then the taste is divine. It's hard to believe that people thought, yeah, this seems great. Let's just, you know, mold is awesome and microbes, yeah, let's go to town. How could that possibly happen?
Well, I think that cheese is a discovery. I learned that from an affineur, a ripener of cheeses in northern Italy. And I think it's really apt. You know, we've been continuing to discover these amazing, you know, products. They're revealed, really, to cheesemakers over time. And it's really the interaction between, you know, the cheesemaker and these microbial communities. I've often described being a cheesemaker as being like God, except blind and dumb, because we can't necessarily see the effects of our actions, but really what we're doing is unleashing these universes of life, these creating these communities and then wiping them out. And a lot of that flavor production is the result of both enzyme production and metabolite production through this fermentation. But also when microbes die, they release all their internal enzymes. And those enzymes really serve to alter the texture and release the flavor that's bound up in these proteins and in these fats that otherwise are rather tasteless. So without the microbes, you know, there's no cheese.
Catherine, jump in here on the microbe discussion. It's fascinating.
It absolutely is. What I think is some of the most interesting work that's been done in science of late, most of the time, people like me, a food microbiologist, will study microorganisms in isolation. But now the molecular biology is available so that we can look at how organisms live in communities with each other. And Dr. Rachel Dutton, who was formerly at Harvard and is now out in San Diego, has perfected technologies to take a look at what organisms comprise the rind of some of Matteo's cheeses, for instance. And the answer is maybe 30 different bacterial genera, most of which we didn't previously associate with cheese. And so this opens a whole Pandora's box into, so what about these species we haven't previously recognized? Where do they come from? What do they do? And how can we even improve on cheese making? But the other exciting part of Rachel's discoveries were, well, what if we look at the cheese rind of a camembert style made in Vermont and compare that with a camembert made in France? Would the microbial communities be similar or different? And her results indicate a very stable microbiome that is manipulated by the cheesemaker. And so you're selecting these 30 different bacterial genera through manipulations of milk, whether it be in Vermont or whether it be in France or other parts of the world. And I think that's amazing.
There's also been some work done on cheese composition that can give us some ideas or some insight into our own gut microbiome.
Yeah, I'm not as familiar with that work, except for the fact that so again, as a food microbiologist, there, you know, everything that I've been taught and all the practices that we use in food production is sanitize this, sterilize that. And what we're learning through the gut microbiome is that a broad bacterial diversity is necessary for our immune systems to function. And I think we're relooking, as Matteo said, cheeses are true living foods. And perhaps science will reveal that we, you know, you look at cheeses that have been consumed for centuries and centuries, and National Geographic did a series a few years back. back looking at longevity in cultures, and one of the longest living populations in the world was in the Mediterranean, where they're consuming a hard sheep's milk cheese, and that was attributed with some of their longevity. So either microbiologically or chemically, these living foods have a role in our in nutrition and optimal health.
We're talking about cheese today. Matteo Keeler, you want to weigh in on that?
Sure. There's been this great research that's been done at INRA, which is the French Agronomic Research Station in Poligny, around the impact of cheese microbes from cheese on the human gut microbiome. And, you know, there is – when you eat a piece of raw milk cheese, those microbes can stick with you for about 2 weeks, and then they'll pass out of your system. So, you know, the consumption of cheese, but not just cheese, you know, a diverse diet actually creates a diverse diversity in your own microbiome. And that, I think, is a lesson, really. Eat lots of different things. Yeah.
Well, and what I'm taking away from this discussion is that my love of all kinds of cheese is really a good thing. I'm feeling very supported in this adoration of cheese that I have and feel like maybe I should be eating more of it every day. We're talking with Matteo Keeler from Jasper Hill Farm. He's brought some of his cheese. We're going to try that next. We're also talking with UVM professor Catherine Donnelly, and we're discussing the new book they both had a hand in, and Catherine is the executive editor of, called The Oxford Companion to Cheese. Call 1-800-639-2211 with your questions about cheese history, composition, or culture. That's 1-800-639-2211, or post a note, maybe your ode to cheese, on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. Catherine Donnelly is a professor of nutrition and food sciences at UVM. Matteo Keeler is co-owner of Jasper Hill Farm in Greensboro. They're talking with us today about the Oxford Companion to Cheese, which they both had a hand in crafting. And we're sharing some of the delicious cheese that Matteo brought. So join our little soiree. You can call 1-800-639-2211 or post a question, a comment, an encouragement of cheese eating on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. So, Matteo, I can't wait any longer. Can you describe some of what you brought in here, and we can taste a little bit, and you can explain, you know, what I might be tasting?
Sure. So I brought four different cheeses here. We've got Alpha Tolman, which we make at Jasper Hill. It's a Gruyere, a hard-cooked press type cheese, named after Greensboro's first philanthropist, Alpha Tolman, built the school and the library in town. Oma from the Von Trapp Farmstead in Waitsfield, they make the cheese on their 40-cow dairy in Waitsfield, and we do all the ripening and marketing and sales for them, as well as Weybridge, which is made at the Skolton Family Farm in Weybridge, Vermont. And lastly, Cabot Cloth Bound Cheddar, which continues to play a really important role in, you know, the function and the development of our business. It's goes right back to the beginning of our Jasper Hill story. Back in 2003, we got a call from Cabot asking us to make for them a English style raw milk cloth bound cheddar, and that was not a very good idea, but we spun it around, and instead they make cheese for us, and we ripen the cheese, and it's been fundamental. It's it won Best of Show at the American Cheese Society in 2006, and we leveraged that big win and our agreement with Cabot to build the cellars at Jasper Hill, and that's enabled us to really provide a range of services, including marketing and sales services to these other smaller cheesemakers, and basically creating access to markets in and out outside of Vermont, so they can really double down and focus on the work that is milking cows and making cheese on a farmstead 7 days a week, never ends.
And that idea that you do have these cellars that many small-scale producers wouldn't be able to have or to have the money to build. And so you do have this space for other cheesemakers to age their cheese.
Correct. I mean, when we deconstructed our experience as a startup farmstead cheesemaker, we recognized that there's more work in taking care of cheese after it's made than there is in milking cows and turning that milk into cheese combined. And it's also the only place you can cut any corners, which is generally what happens. And so by ripening, buying the cheese, we provide cash flow early to our producer partners to help cash flow their day-to-day activities. But we also made the investment in the bricks and mortar, in the labor, and in the marketing, distribution, and all the admin, collections, all that kind of stuff that it takes to really succeed at this farmstead cheese business, which is relentless.
Yeah, that's the second time you've mentioned that. It's hard work you're talking about here.
It is very hard work. And behind every farmstead cheese business is an amazing person, but usually a team of very committed people that make it possible to produce these amazing products. So, you know, I look at farmstead cheesemakers and, you know, they're the hardest working people I've ever met.
You know, Catherine, while I taste this cheese, I'm gonna throw something your way, and I'm sorry you're not in the studio with us to have this wonderful cheese. But in the Oxford Companion to Cheese, there's a limited number of actual cheese producers who are highlighted or who have entries in the book. And among them are the sellers at Jasper Hill, also Grafton Village Cheese, Lazy Lady Farm, Cabot Creamery, Vermont Shepherd. That seems like a really high ratio of Vermont producers compared to the rest of the cheesemaking world. Is that commensurate with Vermont's reputation in the cheesemaking world?
Most definitely, Jane. Of course, you know, when I was tapped to lead the effort in this book, it was really hard not to make this Vermont-centric. So I deferred to my colleagues around the globe, and I'm happy to say that we have 325 authors representing 35 different countries. But I can say unequivocally that all of those people from 35 countries know about Vermont. They know about the revolution in artisan cheesemaking that's occurring here in this very small state. And our cheesemakers are winning international awards and recognition for all of their efforts. And when you look at the Oxford Companion and when I was receiving all of the entries, there's an omnipresent threat out there globally about the impact that food safety regulations may have on traditional foods and traditional cheeses. And I think because of the efforts going on in Vermont, it's giving hope to the rest of the cheesemaking landscape around the globe that perhaps the United States will recognize the value that these traditional products that have been produced for centuries, not only the safety, but the place that they have in our society and its importance. But Vermont, in so many ways, is one of the world leaders in the return back to the working landscape. And it's an extremely important work.
I want to get back into this question of regulations and the regulatory environment and food politics. But before we do, let's get to some of the questions from our callers. And our number, if you have one, is 1-800-639-2211. Roger is calling in from Lyme, New Hampshire. Hi, Roger. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Jane. I've got two questions. One about cheese for lactose intolerant people. Matteo kind of implied that maybe there wasn't lactose in cheese. And the second was when you're storing cheese and it grows mold, is that mold edible?
Good questions, Roger. Matteo?
Roger, those are two really good questions. So in terms of lactose content in cheese, hard cheeses generally don't have any lactose. So lactose is a sugar. It's soluble in the water phase of a cheese. So higher moisture cheeses are going to have more lactose. Lower moisture cheeses like cheddar Gruyere, Alpha Tolman here, have zero lactose, and that's a function of the fermentation of that lactose into lactic acid, and also the fact that when we make these cheeses, we're actually cooking them down and drying the curd out, which reduces the total amount of water and lactose in the cheese. So hard cheeses generally have zero lactose, and higher moisture soft cheeses are going to have some residual lactose. So you can use that as kind of a gauge.
And then in terms of what mold you can eat versus not eat?
Well, we make our living growing mold on cheese. That's basically our business plan. But when I open up the refrigerator and there's a piece of cheese in the back of the fridge there, what I generally do is I'll take a knife and just cut that face off. And generally, that cheese under that surface is going to be A-okay.
How about a rind? How do you know when to eat a rind versus not eat a rind?
All the work is in the rind. Those rinds are soaked in labor. Actually, that's what they taste like to me. I always make a point of tasting the rind. Oftentimes, a rind will add dimension. Sometimes rinds will detract from the overall experience. I basically make that decision on the spot every time I try a piece of cheese. The other interesting thing to try is generally there's a progression and a range of flavor that between the core of the cheese and the rind. So you can actually have, three or four different cheese eating experiences in a single slice of cheese as you nibble your way towards the rind.
Let's go to Eric on the line with us from Montpelier. Hi, Eric. Your question today.
Great program. I grew up in northern Wisconsin drinking raw milk and eating cheese and a Finnish cultured milk called Fili. But my question is very interested in the probiotics in your gut. And what about pasteurized cheeses? Do they still have the bacteria in them? Or how can I tell when I'm getting the cheese with all the good stuff in it?
Eric, thanks for the call. Catherine Donnelly, I'll throw this one your way. And, in answering Eric's question, it may lead us right back to this question of food politics and regulation. So have at it.
Great. Thank you, Eric, for your question. So the process of pasteurization, it's a mild application of heat to specifically inactivate bacterial pathogens, organisms that are going to make you sick. With respect to raw milk itself, for fluid consumption, a lot of consumers think that consuming raw milk will expose them to beneficial organisms. Raw milk really contains not enough probiotic bacteria. So one of the legal definitions of a probiotic culture is something that has like a million living cells. So things like yogurt are great sources of probiotics. Raw milk, not so much. And the other problem is with raw milk, at least in its fluid form, it can contain bacterial pathogens that for certain populations, those who don't have very functional immune systems, these raw milk consumption can cause a lot of problems, and including serious health implications. When we talk about raw milk cheese, the whole purpose of cheese making was to extend the shelf life of milk. So originally, this was a way to preserve milk for future consumption safely because of the activity of organisms involved in the cheese making process. Now, Eric's question specifically was, will I get beneficial organisms by consuming cheese made from pasteurized milk? You can have wonderful cheeses made from pasteurized milk in addition to raw milk. Many of the organisms that enter the process of cheese making come after the milk is pasteurized, and because of the low pH, the acidity, and especially with a hard cheese, so there's less moisture, you're creating a very microbiologically safe product. The organisms that grow on rinds or even pasteurized milk, cheesemakers like Matteo will add cultures back to that milk after it's pasteurized to help in the selection process of these beneficial organisms that cheesemaking technology depends on. So I would say to Eric, eat that cheese. It's a great source of organisms, and Wisconsin is also featured, a shout out to Wisconsin, Eric. Wisconsin has long been a cheesemaking state in the United States, you know, recognized for its efforts in that area, and we prominently feature the Wisconsin cheesemakers in the book.
And Matteo, you know, I've only given you a minute here now to go into something that it probably consumes much of your brain space and life. And this is this question of regulations and this question of, you know, raw cheeses and are they allowed and what are the government regulations coming in? So, you know, just briefly, how do you think about that as a cheesemaker, the fact that there are these sort of blanket regulations that come in that affect your business?
It's the biggest business risk that we face is not a microbiological risk. It's actually a regulatory risk. Everything from the way that we manage our cropland to the practices we have in place in production are oriented towards maximizing public health, really. But also, you know, our farming practices are really about creating microbial diversity because the flavor potential in a cheese is linked and correlated directly to the microbial diversity in the raw milk that it's made from.
Well, both Matteo and Catherine talk about regulations in their beginnings to the book. Matteo wrote the foreword, Catherine wrote the introduction, and she is the editor-in-chief of the Oxford Companion to Cheese. Catherine Donnelly is also a professor of nutrition and food sciences at UVM. Thank you so much for being on the program. And Matteo Keeler is co-owner of Jasper Hill Farm in Greensboro. Matteo, thanks to you for bringing in such delicious cheese. I can barely talk because all I want to do is eat. I appreciate it.
It's so great to be here. And everybody out there, support VPR. It's a real treasure.
Thank you, Matteo. Coming up next, a remembrance of Pearl Harbor and the attack that happened 75 years ago. You're listening to Vermont Edition. This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. 75 years ago today, Americans absorbed the shocking news of the bombing of Pearl Harbor through grainy radio broadcasts like this.
One moment, please.
1, 2, 3, 4. Hello, NBC. Hello, NBC. This is Honolulu, Hawaii. We have witnessed this morning a severe bombing of Pearl Harbor by enemy planes, undoubtedly Japanese.
The bombing of the U.S. naval base in Hawaii thrust America into war on two fronts, and for nearly everyone, it meant the world as they knew it would never be the same. VPR's Nina Keck reports that people who were alive then have strong memories of the surprise Sunday morning attack on Pearl Harbor and how it shaped their lives.
The story of Pearl Harbor is a personal one in my own family. 7-year-old Janet Heyman Keck, my mom, was there. She says that Sunday morning started out like any other.
We got up and we were going to church, and I was going to Sunday school. I remember that.
Her father, Commander Claude Heyman, was a Navy pilot on the staff of the USS Tennessee, stationed at the base near Honolulu. When the bombing started, the family of three was at home together.
And there was a terrific amount of noise, just big explosions, like something had blown up, foom, foom. And there were in the area a couple of bombs that fell in town. And I do remember hearing the whistling and just seeing, kind of panicky, and mainly because I saw, you know, my mother panicky and the adults around me panicky, and that whistling was a terrible, worse than the booms.
By 8 a.m., hundreds of Japanese fighter planes were dropping bombs in an attack that would go on for several hours.
We turned on the radio, and this poor announcer was saying, like, and almost, this is an enemy attack. All military personnel, get to your bases.
At that point, my mom says her father, who was still dressed in his best white linen suit, left the house and drove to the naval base. It would be almost 2 weeks before they heard from him again. While my grandfather survived the attack, more than 2,000 military personnel and civilians did not. My mother and millions of others listened anxiously the next day as President Franklin Delano Roosevelt declared war.
We all got together in one pretty big room, and we had a radio, and I remember most of the other wives came, and the men were gone by that time, into our room when Roosevelt gave his speech. I'm going to have to take a break a minute.
Yesterday, December 7th, 1941, a date which will live in infamy, the United States of America was suddenly and deliberately attacked by naval and air forces of the Empire of Japan.
Rutland resident Lasita Cook was 18 and living in Hartford, Connecticut, when she heard that speech. She says the day before, she'd been on a church group outing when their bus driver broke the news about Pearl Harbor.
Usually we do a lot of chattering and laughing and talking. Nobody said a word. It was like getting kicked in the gut. Pearl Harbor. From then on, just our world was going to be different. And half the kids were talking about whether they're going to join the Navy, the Air Corps. They got to join one of the services. They were that gung-ho to get into this battle.
Cook was no different. She enlisted in the Women's Army Corps when she turned 20 and served in the South Pacific and New Guinea.
We were mostly secretaries. You know, every outfit has to have a headquarters, and every headquarters has to have paperwork.
Cook shows me several photos of herself in uniform. In one, she's holding a rifle. She was an excellent shot, she says, nodding.
But we didn't have guns. I guess I thought we were going to have guns. I'd love to have been in the Army now. Gee, what a difference.
Donald Shedd of Wallingford was 19 when Pearl Harbor was attacked. Even before the bombing, the looming war had affected his family. Shedd's father had sold their farm in Center Rutland to take a job with a defense contractor in Connecticut. That's where Shedd, his two brothers, and two sisters were living when they heard about Pearl Harbor.
I know as soon as we knew what was going on over there, us three boys were deciding what to do. Everybody was joining, and we had to wait till Paul was 18 so he could join us. So it was February when we finally joined the Marines.
All three boys ended up in the South Pacific, and all three were wounded in action. Bob in New Britain, Paul during the Battle of Guadalcanal, and Donald on Peleliu. But all three made it home. Lasita Cook had to fight off dengue fever, but she too was able to return home after the war. Her beloved older brother Kenneth Gregg was not so lucky. He was an Army Air Corps lieutenant and just 21 when he was killed in a plane crash in 1943. December 7th is a day she'll never forget, says Cook, but she prefers to remember August 15th, the day in 1945 when the war in Japan ended. She says it's hard to describe the sense of relief people felt.
Just the opposite of Pearl Harbor. This great giant thing had been lifted, and no more guys were going to kill and be killed in Japan. And they gave us a day off. We're not working today.
She picks up a photo of her brother in his pilot uniform. His face looks impossibly young. She tells me even after all these years, she still thinks about him and misses him. My grandfather was also killed in 1943, rescuing his men from a fire in their military quarters. He received the Naval and Marine Corps Medal for his heroism. My mom has it hanging in her bedroom. For VPR News, I'm Nina Keck.
Tomorrow on Vermont Edition, we'll hear about the best practices for combating impaired drivers, including new testing and detection methods. And we'll hear how marijuana legalization has impacted Colorado's highways. Tune in for that discussion live tomorrow at noon. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.